our help is, our people got up, how many people here are still working on Hummer One? That kind of. Well, got Bright Electra off early and go to layout mode and kind of, I'll help you get started and everybody else through the rush lights, okay? Last meeting, which was our first meeting, we talked about cafeteria bid papers. I have any questions about that? What I want to talk to you briefly about is your Hummer Two assignment. Hummer Two assignment is, to create a prime number discovery program using the algorithm known as the sieve of Eratosthenes. So let me go over this. This is the model that all your assignment documents will follow pretty much. So it has a title, a due date, and I try very hard to keep that due date and one on the calendar page. Just saying, you ever see a discrepancy there and inconsistency, be sure to let me know. You've got educational objectives, and they are to experience using bit vector objects and applications, experience using make files, organize, compile, multi-file applications. Your operational objectives, this is like the list of things you got to get done, right? You want to provide a client program whose file is named sieve.cpp. It's a client for the class FSU bit vector. It implements the sieve of Eratosthenes algorithm to compute all prime numbers less than or equal to an input integer, and provide a makefile to create an executable sieve.x. So your deliverables are two files, a sieve.cpp file and the makefile. So the next thing I'm going to do is make a policy, making sure the homework is a doable assignment prior to assignment. So notice I just typed make. So after your submission, I should be able to do that in your submission portfolio folder for this homework. Make should do sieve.x, and sieve.x should take like this. Enter max, and it spits out the primes less than or equal to max. Notice that it's a very simple one shot. Right? You hit the up arrow key and do it again. That's your move. It's a finger on your right hand. Okay. That was 10. Try 100. 1,000. 10,000. I don't think it worked right. Well, I'm surprised. It's basically a question of how many bits can you get into out of the bit vector. That implies I'm getting 100,000 bits, obviously, right? So I'm entering 100,000. So my bit vector for the sieve of Eratosthenes got 100,000 bits. 100,000 divided by 8 is what? 12,500 bytes. I guess that's still not too big. Yeah. What was that last one? 100,000? Yeah. Oh. I think maybe. That's 100,000. Million is probably going to break, right?
Oh.
I must have done something to make
this
work for bigger
numbers. This is
what I'm thinking. Okay, so that's a million bit. That's a bit vector of size 1 million. Now, you try to make a vector of an int of size 1 million, I would guess that you would be refused on that. So, the point is a bit vector can store has 8 times as many bits as the biggest vector you can make, the biggest array you can make. The point, I guess, is this is pretty fast. I think the time consumed here is the display time. This is one of my favorites, 50,000. Who knows what the largest prime less than 50,000 is? Less than 50,000. Well, no, it's not 50,000. But it's one less, 499. Anyway, so that's the way the sieve is supposed to play. The surprising thing is that this is important in applications because when we get to towards the end of the semester, we'll get to something called a hash table. And the internal structure of a hash table will require the computation of a prime number on the fly. And we'll be using the sieve of Eratosthenes to do that. So if you're kind of working on something that ultimately is going to be a part of something else that you've got to do in your next project. for that is, what else was it? So let's talk about the civil rights in these algorithms. Everybody see the board pretty well? Idea is, I think I demonstrated this for you with the keyboard last time. Let me just get you to look at me, and let me see if I can hand wave you through it. So you're going to think of your bit vector as starting on, I'm behind the vector, you're in front of it. So the bit vector starts here and grows in this direction. Grows from left to right, like positive numbers grow in the same direction. What you're going to do is take this bit vector and start off by, you can do it, of course, leave a 0 or 1. Yeah, okay, so we're set all of bits, meaning make all the bits equal to 1 in the whole bit vector. And we made this long enough so that there's an index for each number between 0 and the prime that you want to know, I mean the number, sorry, you don't know it's prime, the number that gets entered by the user. You want bit 0 through that number in this bit vector. So that means the number of the bit vector has to have size 1 greater than a number entered by you. Anyway, so you have this bit vector. You set all the bits equal to 1. And then what we're going to do is start clearing bits for the things that we know are not prime. You clear 0 because it's not prime. Clear 1 or unset. Unset 0, unset 1. Leave 2 set because we know 2 is prime. This is where we start out our looping. So 2 is prime, so you start a loop at this point. You clear 0, clear 1. Your loop is for the outer part of the loop goes up the indices slowly. The outer part of the loop. And then inside of that loop, I says, see if this index is 1. If it is, then we know that number is prime because otherwise it would have been cleared or unset by one of the previous operations. So it starts with 2, which we know is prime. So you say, if the bit is 1, then you look at all multiples of that index value and clear the bits for all the multiples. So we kept 2 set, but we cleared 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, all of it. Then we increment to 3. 3 is still set, therefore 3 is prime, therefore we will clear all the multiples of 3. So we clear 6, 9, 12, so on, all the multiples of 3. And that is the loop structure. It's a double loop. It's one loop inside of another loop. Now, there are some tricks you can deploy to make that slightly more efficient. But the question is, why does this work? Because at the end, what, you do this all the way through, and at the end, all the bits, all the indices whose bits are still set are prime numbers in that range. And here's the reasoning. Suppose that one of these numbers in that range is not prime. That number is divisible then by some prime number. And by the way, it's divisible by a prime number less than or equal to its own square root. Well, suppose you got an n. If n is not prime, then n is divisible by some prime. If p is prime. So it's the product of two other integers for p is prime. If Q is not prime, then it's divisible by primes and so on. So you can actually write this as a factorization of primes. Right? And what I claim is if you take the smallest one of these primes, it's certainly got to be less than or equal to the square root of n. Because the smallest one of these, so you let B, let's just assume B is the smallest prime that divides n, and Q is the product of all the ribs. Well then, I claim that P has to be less than or equal to Q because Q is the product of all the other primes that divide in, and P was the smallest. So the square root of n is a number such that what it multiplied by itself is n, right? So that square root has to be bigger than or equal to P because P is less than or equal to Q, and P times Q is n. So, all right, so let me go back. If a number is not prime, it's divisible by a prime, and in fact, it's divisible by a prime that's less than or equal to the square root of that number. So that means that, forget about the square root for a minute, that means that this number's bit has to have been cleared by one of those loops that cleared the bits of all the multiples of the primes. And in fact, I could have just done that I could have stopped the outer loop of that clearing operation when it got up to be the square root of the number of bits in this bit vector, because clearing, not clearing, just considering the primes less than or equal to the square root of that largest number will be sufficient to get them all. So here's the way that algorithm can be stated a little bit more formally. Begin with the bit vector index from 0 to n. Initialize by setting all the bits. Clear b of 0 and b of 1 because they're 0 and 1 are not prime. The k between 2 and the square root of n, that's using that square root operation. Step size 1, in other words, 4. If you want to make a for loop for k, 4 k equal to k less than or equal to n plus plus k. That's the way to write that for loop. If b of k, b is a bit vector. B, and of course I'm writing it here as though it were an array. But of course, you can't do it this way. But if the k bit is set, then for j between k plus k and n, step size k, clear that bit. This is the part about clearing all the multiples of one that you discovered is prime. Every time you run across a prime, you clear all of its multiples in the rest of the bit vector. You keep riding up through the bit vector like that. When you get up to the square root of the size of the bit vector, then you can solve it. Okay, so that is the sieve process, and the theorem is that after the sieve process, the indices with set bits are prime numbers, and the indices with cleared or unset bits are not prime numbers. So that's the algorithm. Procedure requirements, work in your homework 2 directory. Again, by copying live slash submit scripts slash HW2 submit SH into your assignment directory and change its permissions to execute. Create the two files, civ.cpp and makefile, and then turn in those two files using the submit script. Finally, down to the technical requirements. File civ.cpp should contain two functions, void civ and int main. Note that void civ takes an FSU bit vector by reference, not const reference, by the way. So that takes it by reference, which means that if you operate on that BB, it's being changed in the calling program. So that's just what you want. So this allows civ, the function civ, to go through precisely that civ Veritas-Lenz algorithm. And when it returns, of course it doesn't return back, but when it returns a throw back to main, BB will have had that process done through. And so all main's got to do is make a loop that outputs the indices whose bits are set, and doesn't output the indices whose bits are not set. So what I want you to do, in other words, is isolate the civ of Eratosthenes algorithm in this function. So encapsulate it in that function. And that function does no IO, it doesn't interact with the user or anything. All it does is a bit vector comes in and it does the civ of Eratosthenes to that bit vector. And then it's over. What main does is query the user to enter a number. It might output some sort of explanation about what it's doing before that. Then it queries the user for a number, reads that number. Then it creates a bit vector of the appropriate size, which as I pointed out to you, would be one more than the number the user entered. And then it's got to hand that bit, then it makes the call to civ, where it does civ on that bit vector. And then it does a loop that simply outputs all these set, all indices of set bits. And then main is over. Now, the one subtlety here, how can you know what size bit vector to make in your source code? You can't, because the size of the bit vector you have to make is being entered by the user. So, what that means is, you've got to create that bit vector with operator view after the user enters the parameter. Okay, so let's see if I've said everything I need to say. Function civ takes a bit vector object by reference and forms a civ algorithm on it. So that when the function returns, bits of BB are set if and only if the index of the bit is prime. It's a function only, it does not do any interaction with users, screens, or files. Function main should handle the IO, query the user for a project manager, and output a list of all primes that are less than or equal to the end. Then I want you to write a makefile that creates files, bitvac.o, civ.o, and one executable civ.exe. Your make files create bitvac.o directly from the course library, directory data, without copying the source code into your project. There's a couple hints there. First one's telling you that an executable is distributed in Area 54, and the other one's telling you a hint about your make file. Okay, question about that? That's due next week. Questions or comments? Let me tell you where we are then. If you look up the calendar, we want to talk about chapter 3 today, and if I have time, I'm going to also talk about chapter 4. I'd really love to get ahead. If I got ahead, it won't mean we cover more material, it'll just mean we finish early. But it'll really be helpful to get through stuff fast. It just helps you get your projects done. First of all, give us time to work on projects during class. Secondly, you have more knowledge earlier to get the projects done. Anyway, so chapter 3 is going to talk about strings, and it's going to introduce, it's going to review the situation with respect to string, C strings, and then introduce a string object class. It's an FSU library, and that string class you may use, you may also use the SED library string object class if you want to. Then next time, the next chapter is on hashing, and I just want to talk briefly about hash functions, and then briefly about templates. So the two real short chapters that for some of you, 33 last semester, both of those will be reviews, but not everybody within that course. I'm going to go over those. Then I'm going to talk about vectors, which will be your first so-called container class for the course. We'll talk about vector objects, and I have some text reading. It's optional, but you might find helpful for vectors. I have some more for lists here. I'll put in for some other things. Once I've got hashing and vectors talked about, then you will have enough under your belt to discuss project one, which is a password server project. That will be due middle of February. February 13th. We want to then take kind of a tangential route, talk about algorithms a little bit. I'm going to talk about sequential search and binary search algorithms. I'm going to talk about algorithm complexity, how you measure, or how you compare the runtime of two algorithms, and so on. So that'll give us some search algorithms. It'll also give us some vocabulary to talk about runtime of things, which will be necessary. Then we'll go back to our container construction. This next one we'll build will be a list container, and that's what Chapter 8 is about. The third one we'll build is a deck container, and that's what Chapter 9 is about. And Chapter 10 is abstract data types, where we'll study ADTs in general, and we'll study stacks, and we'll study queues, and that will be the last formal thing before midterm exam. Going back to the project side, password server project is going to use vectors and binary search. So binary search is in Chapter 7 here. And so it was a little bit of a problem. So I'm wondering, I'm kind of hoping to get a little bit ahead. Project 2 is basically using techniques for lists, linked list structures, to make something called a ring buffer. Project 3 is called a wrap pack, and it's going to use stacks and queues to control search algorithms to simulate the solution of a maze. And so the week before spring break, we have a midterm, then we have spring break. Then we come back. You might look out and get this done before you leave. Function objects, iterators, generic algorithms. And I have a homework that's all just an extra, like a weightlifting exercise involving function objects. And then we'll talk about tables, in particular hash tables. And I'm going to give you the internet router assignment, which is project 4. It uses hash tables. And then finally, we'll talk about heaps. And I'll give you a homework assignment related to heaps, which I'll talk about priority queues. I hope y'all noticed that this the plan is to be completely through new material at least 2 weeks before in the semester. It'd be nice to get finished even earlier than that, so we can meet, talk about getting these, all these projects. It's project four and homework four are both pretty, non-trivial projects. So, you absolutely cannot get behind on your project deadlines here. So that will be a disaster for you if that happens. Okay, so let's go back to no questions about calendar. Let's go for bid vectors or homework two. Let's start talking about streams. So what we're going to do is critique C strings and talk about the need for a proper type and then introduce the string quiz. C strings, as you know, are just pointers to type care. It's a clever device that's been around since the early days of computing. The way a C string works is there's a special character called the null character, represented in C++ and in C by the \0 symbol. It does have an ASCII code. It is a genuine character, but of course it represents nothing. It's sort of the Seinfeld character. And it's not something you want to output to a screen, because when you tell the screen to do nothing, sometimes the screen does something anyway that you don't expect. So it's not a character you want to try to output, but it is a character. So what C did is build up a way of handling strings. And of course, strings are important because they represent words, right? And data, numbers are thought at the core of strings. Number representation of strings. And the whole language of computing and everyday life is built around strings. And so obviously computer programs have to be able to deal with these things. And C developed a way of doing it, which is actually pretty clever. What C does is say, okay, I'll have a pointer to type care. Now, that means that you've got some address in memory. And the fact that it's a pointer to type care means the pointer knows that it's pointing to an object that occupies one byte only, one byte of memory. Now, then what makes this work in C is that there's an agreement that strings, that the end of the string, the beginning of the string will be denoted by the pointer, which tells you the address of its first character. The end of the string will be the null symbol character. And so you'll have a data-dependent notion of how you get to the end of the string. But that way, if you assume strings have this property, they're well-formed, then you can devise algorithms to deal with strings. For example, you can compute the length of a string by just starting at the 0 element for that pointer and keep counting until you get to a null character, and that count is the number of characters in the string, for example. The problems with this, though, were unanticipated when C was designed. But now, with kind of a modern view of how things can go bad, we see that there's a couple problems with that. Namely, these hidden assumptions that have to be enforced by human energy and aren't enforced by computation. So if someone forgets to null terminate a string and hand it to one of these algorithms, and that algorithm is going to overrun the end of that memory that was allocated to that string and keep going until some null character in the memory or somewhere is encountered. The second hidden assumption is that memory has in fact been allocated. So just because you have a pointer to some type doesn't mean that it owns any memory. And so these turn out to be both significant area pitfalls for crashing programs, for even security breaches of various kinds. And so they've been kind of notoriously difficult to deal with for a long time. And you still have to deal with strings. You can't get away from them, but the general recommendation in C++ is to use them as little as possible. And when you do use them, of course, be very careful to make sure that those two hidden assumptions are true, are verified. The reason you have to keep using strings is that, just legacy code. Even the open member function for an OF stream in C++ requires a char star variable to carry the file. It doesn't require a string on it, it requires a care starter. And so, you know, it's just, you can't get away from C-strings. But when you get in any kind of serious manipulation, you definitely want to go to string objects instead. So here is a possible, here's a way that the output operator could be written for a string, a C-string. This would be, this is effectively the way the output operator is overloaded for a C-string. So the idea is you want to output this C-string str, and of course it's just a pointer, but you assume that memory's been allocated and the string's been all terminated. So what you do is you dereference that string pointer. You don't see that one on highlight? So, you see that or is it blocked out? Okay. Is it disconcerting that you'd rather me not highlight? Okay. You dereference that string pointer, which gives you the character that it's pointing to, and you ask if it's, well, you test it to see if it's equal to this null character, and if it's not, then you put that character into the string and then increment the pointer. Remember, incrementing a pointer just moves to the next memory location, the next footprint, the next memory location, considering the type of the pointer. Now, this particular pointer is a type char, so it's pointing only a single byte, so that would literally, in this case, move one address up in memory. And then do it again. So you keep out the character and you get to the null set. There's some rhetorical questions here. How is the assumption of null termination used? Well, it's to make the loop quit, right? How is the assumption of memory allocation used? Well, when you do this, you assume you're operating in memory that's been assigned to your running program or been loaned to you legitimately by some other running program. And that's the assumption of memory development. Now here, if memory hasn't been allocated, it's sort of not going to do any harm. Remember, where it does real harm when memory's not allocated is when you're inputting a string and writing over stuff. So here's a possible implementation of strcpy, which if you recall, copies right-hand string to the left-hand string. Notice, and this is another member of the string.h library, strcpy. Notice what that's going to do is, dereference str1, which is the one on the right, and see if that its character value is null. If it's not, it's going to copy that character value to the character value on the left string, and then increment both pointers. You may be thinking, well, how come you can increment that pointer? Because we said const here. Const char star associates like this. So when you say const char star, you mean I want a pointer to constant char. So that means that the thing the pointer points to is not going to be allowed to be changed. This pointer itself can't change. And of course, we're not going to change what this points to because we're using it on the right-hand side of the assignment, not the left-hand side of the assignment. The one here is being passed in with no const, and so the thing, the stuff it points to will be allowed to be changed, and that's exactly what you want. Now, this, if, let's see, the assumption that str1 is null terminated is used implicitly, clearly. The assumption that str2 is going to allocate sufficient memory is used implicitly, right? Because you're writing over that memory by incrementing that pointer. So if that memory hasn't been allocated, you're writing over something else's memory. It could be anything. It could be part of the machine code you're running program and cause a crash and the thing was or not. By the way, note that the very last thing that happens is that the null character is placed at the end of str2. And that's legitimate. That happens in the strcpy algorithm. So these two, str2 and str1, str2 has to have at least as many characters allocated as str1. And that's one more than the number that's in the actual word you're trying to represent, because you have to have that extra character for the null character at the end. So, we have the concept of proper type, should be responsible for its own data, meaning that it keeps the data protected from client tampering and keep the data protected from other programs. I guess that's redundant because the client is another program. Type should be responsible for its own behavior, so if you want to document the behavior, make the behavior available to clients, and implement the behavior separately out of public view. and the tax review is responsible for its own existence. The client needs a variable of property type. Asking for it should be enough. It shouldn't have to be a lot of worry about, well, did the memory get allocated for this variable? So. And when a client stays for the variable, it should go away peacefully. In other words, when it goes out of scope, it should not cause a memory problem in any way. So if the C++ class captures this notion of property type, class objects are responsible for their own data, keep the data in the non-public area of the class, and control access to the data through public methods. Class objects are responsible for their own behavior, document behavior in the public methods, and keep the implementation and performance of the interface. And finally, they're responsible for their own existence, so the class has appropriate constructors and destructors, and the assignment operator and copy constructor are appropriately implemented. So one of these things then will be a property type. So what we want to do is make string objects that are property types, so we can handle them, so we can handle strings as easily as we handle ints. We don't have to worry about null termination, we don't have to worry about allocating. So what we'll do, so we start saying, okay, what do we want in there? Well, we want to be able to compare strings. Know when two are equal or not, less than or equal to, and so on. What would less than mean for two strings? It'll mean alphabetical order, basically, or a generalization of that. It's called lexicographic order. And it basically means, if you think of the whole ASCII character set as an alphabet, it's alphabetical order in that sense. And we'll overload the IO operators output input operators. And these like to become friends because these are going to have access to the data. So your string class will have a public interface that looks like this. A default constructor constructs a string with no characters. A construct a string object around a C string. This, of course, will have to use the implicit assumption that C string is null terminated. But this will make a string object that is a copy of that C string. It won't use that memory. So this will assume that C pointer is a legitimate C string, but it won't take ownership of it. It will make a copy of it and make it a string object. A destructor and a copy constructor. Have the assignment operator and a couple of bracket operators. Person returns a reference to a type of care, and basically what that does is you take an index, string bracket that index returns a reference to the character at that index in that string, in that character in that string. Note that there's a const version of it as well, and that's that's there so that you can access data from a const string object. And you may ask, well, how often do you have a const string object? Well, objects can be temporarily const. For example, if you got that might very well be the parameter of a function. A const reference to a string. And that would allow you, that effectively allows you to pass that string into a function without making a copy of it, which is a deficiency thing. While you're in the body of this function, S is a constant string. If you wanted to access one of S's individual characters, you need a bracket operator, and the fact you have this one would allow that to be done. Now, you'd get an error if you tried to put it on the left-hand side of the assignment, because here, S and K would be an okay thing to do, but having S, K equal to anything would be not okay. This is a reference that's const, and here you are trying to change the thing it points to, change the value that's associated with it. This is kind of a neat point about C++. We can overload this operator twice because even though it's the same name for the operator and it has the same parameter list, adding const changes the prototype of that operator, and that's enough for the compiler to sync between the two of them. And then let's see, some other stuff that's useful is the wrap function, which says if the C pointer is a C string, then I want to be able to wrap that C pointer up in the string object. That's a little bit misleading the way that's described, because again, you don't wrap that C Spring, but a copy of it. I'm gonna see it. I'm gonna see it. There's a get line function, which will read an entire line and put it into the string. One. You can set the size of the string if you want to. The input size and the input of character to fill with. And you can clear a string, which is make the string have size zero. And make it empty. We're going to have a length and a size function. Size is going to return a parameter that you'll see in a moment. Length is going to calculate the length by calling strlen. Those could be different values. And finally, we're going to have this element method, which is going to take an index and return by value the character of that index if the index is in range, and return the null character if the index is not in range. This will be something that won't produce an error, it just returns the null character when n is beyond the size of the string object. So the implementation plan for this, first note that we're going to put it in the namespace FSU. And you do that by just simply using the phrase namespace FSU, and then a brace, and then anything in between there gets into that namespace, and you close the brace at the end. So we're going to have the implementation. We're going to make the input-output operators friends. The public, we're going to add one more function, a static member function called strcmp. Notice that some of the letters in there are capital, first and foremost. That's going to be, I'll tell you what that is in a little bit, but it's going to be analogous to the strcmp function that you have for C-strings. Privately, we're going to have this, it's no surprise, I'm sure, a charSR, a pointer to some data, and we'll call it str, for lack of imagination. And we'll keep the size parameters stored in there. The basic idea here is we're going to allocate memory to this with operator u, and size will be the amount of memory that got allocated minus one. So we're always going to allocate one extra character and make sure the null character is in that last slot. There's also some other private methods that are in here. Just kind of helper methods. One is called clone. Clone is going to receive a string object and make this object a copy of this one it receives. We're going to have a separate error function because there's so many ways to make a mistake. I'm going to have a static method, xstrlen, which calculates the string, the length of a const char star. I'm going to do it myself rather than call the C library. I'm also going to have one that does a string copy and do it myself instead of having a string library. Finally, I'm going to have a safe string, C string allocator called ustr. So let's talk some about these elements. First of all, let's talk about this strcmp. By the way, that was static. Let me remind you what that means in this context. That means that the function is associated with the class rather than the specific objects of the class. Let me remind you that when you have a regular, when you have a function, a method of a class, the object calling, the way you call it is with that notation, right? So let's say B is some class and I've got an object of type B, and I've got some method, the way you call that. I'll call it method one. And you know, you might have two arguments before you call that method. Notice that really method one has three arguments. An implicit argument that is the object making the call. So that's kind of a zero argument. And then the two that are explicitly mentioned over here, one and two. So when you have a regular method, there's really an extra argument that doesn't appear inside the parenthesis, that term, the list, but it appears over here with the dot notation, and that's the object making the call. And typically, these methods will have something to do with the data of the object. So it'll matter which object makes the call, but it'll depend on that object's data. That's what it does. Anything just a simple return of a value like size to more complicated. Now, when you go static, the method is associated with a class, not the object. Now, the implications of that are two. One is that the method cannot, a static method can't use any object data in its implementation because you don't know which object it is, right? It's associated with the class. So there's no, the implicit parameter for a static function is basically ignored. You can think of it as not really existing. And the second thing is you can call it from the class instead of the object as well. So if you have a static method, method two, let's say it has no, and you can call it like this, method two, with no object being mentioned. This is a class, this is just a scope resolution. It's saying I want method two in the scope of class B. Or, if you have an object, you can still do B dot method two, but this is just a way of, this is interpreted like this. When you call it this way, it's interpreted like this. So the fact that it's being called by a specific object is really irrelevant. So what it boils down to is that a static method is just a way of having it be within the namespace of the class instead of global. So outside the class namespace, the thing will exist. It only exists inside the class namespace. That's really the effect. Okay, so here's this thing, strcmp, and here's what it's supposed to do. This is mimicking the C string function. It's supposed to return 0 if the two string objects are equal. It's supposed to return a negative number if the first string is less than the second string in lexicographic work. And it's supposed to return a positive number if the first string is bigger than the second string in lexicographic work. And the reason we needed to do this is because to take care of the special cases. Because a string object, there's sort of two ways a string object can have size 0. And those will get confused by the C string function. String object, remember, it has two data items, str and size. Str is a pointer to type care. Size can be 0, and this pointer can be null or 0. And that's a legitimate size 0 string object. Or size can be 0, and this pointer can be pointing to an allocation of one character that has null character. That's also a string of size 0. And just to get around that, mess, what this does is say that if the first one has size 0 and the second one has the size 0, then we're going to say they're equal. So in particular, this is asserting those two are going to be considered equal string objects. If the first one has size 0 and the second one doesn't, then we're going to say that the first one is less than the second one, we'll return a minus 1. If the first one is non-zero size and the second one has 0 size, we're going to return a plus 1 because we're going to say the second one is less than the first one. Finally, get down to here, and we take when you get to this point, neither one of the strings has size 0, and we can therefore go down to the old strcmp from the string.h library and just call the result of that. So return the result of that. So the reason for redoing it is just to handle the special cases for the constraint. It will be strange for the classic function. Clear is going to see if there is memory allocated to the string, and if it is, delete it. And this is both str and size equals 0. Clone is a dangerous operation, which is the main reason it's private, but you have to use it under the right circumstances. You've got an incoming string. You set size equal to incoming string dot size. if the size is positive, get some memory and copy the data from the incoming string into the memory you got. Otherwise, if the size is equal to zero, then set this pointer to zero. So that will be how we clone S. Notice that the reason this is dangerous is if memory had already been allocated here, then this would orphan that memory. So if you already have memory allocated to this string, ABC, this would be then size 3, then that code right there would say, okay, that would end up getting a new bunch of memory the size of this, and this memory here that it used to point to would be forgotten and lost, introducing a so-called memory leak into every client program that used the clone, that used this thing. Remember, client programs with memory leaks are bad. Libraries with memory leaks are bad exploiter because they guarantee that every client program uses that library. This is that safe allocator I talked about in UString. It creates a new C string of size n, that is to say array size n plus 1, with memory allocation error message. That's all it's doing. So we have to declare a local C pointer. If the incoming parameter is bigger than or equal to 0, then we let C pointer be new care n plus 1, because we need that extra slot for the null character. Then this is the error check. If we got the memory, fine. Otherwise, we have a memory allocation check. And then we make sure that n plus first slot, because index value to n gets the null character. Else has to do with n comes in negative, then we just set C pointer equal to 0. Either case, we just return it when we finish. So what this does is go through this little bit of logic, including checking for a failed memory allocation, instead of having to keep repeating that over and over throughout the implementation of this string class. XSTRLEN is going to be essentially the same. It's the implementation that we had on the slide a little while ago. Same with this XSTR copy. And this error is going to be, note that it takes a message string as a parameter, and what it's going to do is output that message string and exit. Again, just a time saver, cluttering up code in the other implementations. So, recapping, we've got strcmp, which is going to be allow us to implement all the comparison operators, right? We've got clone, which is going to be useful in our copy constructor and our assignment operator and our, I'm not sure what else, I might be wrong. UString, every time the UString just replaces an operator new with the logic surrounding good application operator new everywhere. And then these others are just our own implementations of the standard string library calls. So now your comparison operators are all going to be accomplished with that strcmp. You can just note that strcmp is a function standalone but inside the scope of the string class. So we just compare, call strcmp with the two strings, and if that value turns out to be zero, then they're equal. If it turns out not equal to zero, then they're not equal. If it turns out positive, then S1 is bigger than S2, et cetera, et cetera. The output operator is really simple. You just output S dot SDR, the underlying C string. And then, of course, you've got to return the reference O string as a value. The hardest part of this is, the most tedious part of this is implementing the input operator. And before I talk about that, let's take a time out and talk about what input operator, what is expected behavior for an input operator. Um, So there's a cultural expectation about behavior for input operators, and then there's kind of this Z plus plus expectation on top of that. When we type stuff in, we type things that represent other things. When you type, you're making a string, basically. But what we call that, in, for example, suppose you type 1, 2, 3, 7, 4, and you intend that to mean a number, not a string. You could read that as an integer. So if we intend it as a number, it's probably not intuitive to call it a string, right? So we have this term that we apply to these things, and the term is token. You'll run across this a lot more in other classes as you continue on through the night. So a token is really a string that represents an object. A single object. Now, when you write source code and you make up the name for a variable, my function, that's a string that represents a function, an entity that's a function, right? So that my function is a token, and it's a token that represents a certain function. Now what? So just compiling a program, the first thing you've got to do is take the source code and break it up into tokens. The individual characters of that source code don't mean anything. It's the tokens of the source code that means something. The first act in a compiling of a program is to break it into a string. Instead, it's to convert it from a string of characters into a string of tokens. But anyway, so back to the subject at hand, you've got the input operator. What the input operator expects to do is, when you overload it for a given type, it expects to read a token and then convert that token into an object of the type that's supposed to be overloaded for. A token will be represented by a string surrounded by clear space. That's the way users represent things. So we use clear space as a delimiter, if you like. So this input operator has to read a token converted into an object. But we're overloading it with string objects now, so we've got to read a token and convert it into a string object. Well, so there's this logic of how do you get to the token and how do you get to the end of the token without reading any more out of the stream than you have to. So what you got to do is skip clear space until you get to the first visible character. That will be your first character token. And you want to read visible characters until you get to the next clear space character. Don't read yet. When you do that, then you want to convert that thing you just read into an object. And this, in our case, a string object. So the wrap function, that's the third place we're going to use that. So the hard part of this is getting through the logic of reading all those characters, but not reading anything beyond the last character. What we're going to do is store them in just a character array while we're reading them. So that is essentially we're going to be creating a C string while we read. And then when we're done reading, we'll wrap that C string into a string object and we'll be done. So the logic of getting to the first character is fortunately already handled because the input operator is already overloaded for type care. And what this will do is notice that X is a type care. What this will do is skip clear space and then read that token, which is a single character, into the first single character into X. That's a character token, not a string token. So that conveniently skips all the clear space up to the first character and reads the first character for us. And of course, that could have failed because it could have been nothing in the string, right? No visible character in the string. So. But assuming we found a character in there, so what we're going to do is make a buffer, which is basically a character array. We'll call it buffer. It's a character array. We're going to start storing characters in there one at a time until we get to the end of this string token. And the rest of this logic is working through that. So the first thing we do is put X in there and then increment the current size of the buffer. Note that buff size was initialized to something called init buff size, which was a static constant equal to 25. So there's a problem here. You don't even know how many strings a person's going to input. I mean, how many characters a person's going to input. So anyway, what we do is we peek And while that thing we peaked at is not blank, or new line, or tab, the three clear space characters, and you haven't reached the end of the file, then we got that if statement wrong. You take the buffer, at the current size of the buffer, assign X to that, and then increment current size. And then you get that character, which basically removes it from the screen, and you peek at the next character. And you keep doing this over and over until you get, until this file fails by reading a clear space character, by peeking, rather, at a clear space character. And this is what ensures you from never actually reading that first clear space character beyond the string in front of you. This if part is the timeout you have to take when the amount of memory you had exceeds, it is used up. And so when current size becomes buff size, then you need more buffer. And so we double the size of the buffer, create a new buffer, dynamically copy the stuff from the old buffer, the new buffer that we already found, and then delete the old buffer, and then replace buffer by new buffer, and go back to what we were doing. Messy, but handy. Because now, you can read a string directly to the string. Anyway, so now we make, finally, the buffer curse out equals null. So we have, in this final buffer, we've got all those characters plus the null character in. It's a legitimate C string. And then we wrap it up with the wrap function, and that makes S, if we call S.wrap, that'll make S a string object containing the same characters as that buffer does. And then we delete this buffer, remember it was not anything allocated. And finally we return the string. So that's a long, drawn out thing, but it works. And then everything else is sort of, you know, we've done all the heavy lifting. Constructor, the default constructor just sets everything to zero. The constructor around the C pointer calls wrap. Destructor calls delete. The copy constructor calls clone, which is not dangerous because copy constructor is called when the string is being created, when this is being created, so there's no memory allocated to worry about. Assignment operator is where you got to worry about it. If you're not assigning to yourself, then you first want to clear, which will get rid of the memory allocated, and then clone, and then return start. So this is kind of a classic pattern for the implementation of assignment operator. First guard against self-assignment. Then assignment has two stages. Get rid of the allocated resources for this object, and then make yourself into a clone of that object. And then finally return the self-reference. There's a bracket operator, the reference operator. This is no longer. That's out. Don't do that anymore. So anyway, I'm going to leave it. The get line is sort of semi-thankful as well. Set size follows the same kind of thing we did in the input operator. First of all, if the size you want is the same as the size you've got, do nothing, right? Because you're already there. So if the size is different, then you want to resize to that specified size. And you know, the logic of this is somewhat complicated by the fact that you don't know whether the new size is bigger than or less than the old size. So that's what these two things do, is divide it up into the case where the new size is less than the old size, in which case you just preserve as much data as you can, and that's all you can do. Or if the new size is bigger than the old size, then you preserve all the data from the old string and use the fill character to fill up the remaining slots. Anyway, once you've done all that, then you delete the old string and replace str with the new data address and replace size. Size returns size. This had to be this doesn't work anymore. This automatic type conversion thing has been disabled in the new compilers, and so this doesn't work. You can still return length by just, what you do is you call it, instead of on star this, you call str len on the str data item itself. Thank you. let's take a scratch break. You got the Darren Billings coming.